So now, without further ado, I have the pleasure of introducing tonight's speaker. She has a sobriety date of 7/7/89. I had to ask her twice because I thought maybe that was her birth date, but it was her sobriety date. With her, and I think she has not been restored to full sanity because for some reason she moved here from San Diego, and I don't know why she ever left San Diego. Her favorite slogan is, "There is a God and I am not it." So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Sandra B.
Hi everyone, I'm Sandra, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Sandra!
I have coffee mouth. So I'm going to try to clean that up so it's not distracting me. I'm already cooking.
It might be because
I did not get sober when I was 4, but anyways, it's so good to be here. It's an honor and a privilege to be speaking in front of this group. I did move here recently. I moved from North San Diego County in Vista, California, which is smack dab between Escondido and Oceanside, just south of Camp Pendleton. If some of you may know where a few of those places are. I just want to say that last April, my husband and I came out to Visalia to look around and decide whether or not this is somewhere we might want to move. And I went to a couple meetings while I was here because I wanted to check out the AA and see if it was, you know, good enough for me. And and I went to a meeting at the Alano Club. It was either 7 or 8 in the morning, I'm not sure, but it was an early morning Alano Club meeting, and I met a fellow at that meeting. And he was so sweet and so kind and so welcoming. And he said, you know, when you come back in June, look me up. And, you know, the first meeting I came back to in June, when I moved back, he was there. And he's right there. And it's funny because, you know, you get here and it's just like my higher power does for me what I cannot do for myself every single time. And, you know, I've worked very, very hard since I got here to find a community in Alcoholics Anonymous in this new town that I'm in, because it's really just like being a newcomer all over again when you don't really have your people. And I'm like, I need to find my people really fast, because this girl, left to her own devices, gets her in really, really big trouble really fast. I was thinking about, I don't know, I'm not going to try to... My brain can't quote anything, so I'm not going to. I'm thinking about the third step and then talking about our drinking and continuing to try to manage and control. And I was thinking about my thinking. You know, I countless beta tests to prove I could think like other people. And anyways, so I'm going to try to squeeze in a whole lot of stuff. And, you know, I turned this talk over to my higher power tonight. I've turned it over about 1,000 times. So if I say something that hurts your feelings or pisses you off, talk to your sponsor about it. This is God's business right here. I just got to get out of the way every single time. I was born in San Bernardino, California. I'm the oldest of 6 children, the only girl. That means I have 5 baby brothers. My daddy is a drunk. My mommy is an Al-Anon. My mommy doesn't have a program. And my dad got sober 6 months before I did. He introduced me to this program. Before I took my first drink, I had the ism, but it was a little bit of a different kind of an ism. It was an ism in that I thought that my family needed me to run it and to be in charge, because my mom was gone working and my dad was not sober. And I had 5 baby brothers. And, you know, when I was 11 years old, I had already had 2 brothers at that time, and my parents came to us and said, we were thinking about having a couple more kids, and oh, we want to see how you guys feel about that. And I said, it's fine as long as you have a girl. And they didn't. They had another boy. And then they came back and said, we think we're going to have another kiddo. And I said, oh, really? And they said, how do you feel about that? And I said, if you don't have a girl, I'm moving out. And I did. I moved out. And, you know, I was a victim and a martyr, period, end of discussion. I was always looking after my dad. I always thought that I needed to take care of everything. I was either pissed off at him or pissed off at her or pitting, you know, I always felt like I was in the middle, you know, was your dad drinking, you know, and I talked to my mom and I felt like I was a horrible child for talking to my mom about my dad, and then my dad was, you know, it was just this big mess. And you know, my dad used to pass out in this recliner in the living room most every night, if he made it there. Sometimes he was on the ground in the backyard or in the garage somewhere or something. But usually he made it into this recliner. And you know, I said to myself so many times when I grew up, I just don't ever want to be like him because he's the problem. You know, that's the family disease of alcoholism. It creates the thinking in the children and the thinking in the wives and the thinking of the extended family that, you know, if only that person will get sober, then everything will be just fine. And, you know, I've come to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that that's not necessarily the case, because we all get sick from alcoholism. And I was sick from alcoholism before I picked up my first drink, but in a way of being a child of an alcoholic. So the way I grew up, everyone tried to pretend like everything was okay, even when it wasn't, on both sides of the family. I had a really messy, messy, crazy paternal side, and then I had a very neat and tidy and pretty maternal side, and they were all crazy drunks. But one person just tried to look fancier while they were doing it. But I always wanted to drink from as long as I can remember. And as long as I can remember, if there was an opportunity to get a drink, I wanted one. I remember vividly when I was 3 or 4 years old, my dad giving me a shot for a cough. And it stuck out. And anytime there was family get-togethers and I could get a drink, I got a drink. You know, the one thing I had, which got me later, got me sober really young, was a ton of shame and a ton of fear. And that shame and that fear and that wanting you to like me and wanting to look good kept me kind of on the straight and narrow, I guess, in a way. It kept me from doing a lot of stuff that I didn't get in a lot of trouble that I could have gotten into, because I was so driven by fear. I was not driven by care for myself at all. I remember when I got here, people would say, you know, I'm a garbage disposal. And, you know, I'm not really a garbage disposal. I'm just a pure, boring, unadulterated drunk. But I felt like a garbage disposal because I didn't do all those things because I was afraid, but not because I didn't want the effect, or not because I was afraid of the devices or the sharp objects. I wasn't afraid of any of that. I wasn't afraid of the high. I was afraid of what you would think of me, or someone finding out, or that whole how I look. I gotta keep it up. So my first good one was at my home, and we got someone to buy us a bunch of booze. And the bottom line is, I passed out in that chair my dad was passed out in. And I came to about 6 o'clock in the morning-ish, and there was no one in the house. And when the last thing I remember, there was about 40 people in the house. And I came to no one. I came to alone. And that's how it pretty much was from that first time, every single time after that. That was the goal. That was a great time. That was exactly what I was looking for after that. That first time of waking up. I did not like that idea that I was alone. I did not like the idea that everyone stayed up all night partying and they went and watched the sunrise, and I missed that. But it was okay, because I just wanted to do it all over again. I did want to control and enjoy my drinking a little bit. It would have been nice to not always overshoot the mark, but I always overshot the mark. Because I was so damn thirsty. I'd go to parties. I mean, I never really drank beer because it just didn't work fast enough. So, you know, I'd take a drink and didn't work fast enough. So I would drink more, and I would drink faster, more faster, more faster. And I mean, as many times as I can remember, I don't remember how I got home, ever. But I did most of my drinking away from my home. The drinking I did in my home was very much just to take the edge off. I kept enough alcohol around most of the time, just in case I needed to take the edge off. So, before all this started, I was a good girl. I got good grades. I went to school every day. I was in the band. I was on the drill team. When I started to drink the way I wanted to, it all fell apart pretty much immediately. And it was pure pain. There's no other way to put it. It was pure pain and pure shame, and a bunch of people looking at me going, "What are you doing?" And I'm looking at them going, "I don't really care, and you don't understand." And the focus became only one thing. It no longer became what you think of me. It became my next drink, my next drink, my next drink, my next drink without getting in trouble, my next drink without them noticing, my next drink without them bugging me. I mean, it was a lot of work, and I was bad at it. I was horribly bad at it, because the semester before all this stuff got going, I had a 3.5 GPA, and once it all started, I had a 0.65. I mean, it was like... So anyway, in the doctor's opinion, it mentioned the types of alcoholics. And, for years I thought, well, I don't know if I'm that kind, or I don't know if I'm that kind. And, you know, a few years ago, just a few short years ago, I noticed that there's a spot that says, and there's the alcoholic of the manic depressive variety, of which an entire book could be written, or a chapter could be written. And I thought, but they never wrote the chapter. Like, wait a second. That's the chapter that I needed that they never wrote. Because that was me. I mean, I am a depressed alcoholic with a big fat smile on my face. And I got some award in school for having the best smile. You know, like, it was all bullshit. You know, I think back now, like, oh man, I was fearful and resentful, but boy, you didn't know it. And that was my badge of honor. So anyway, so my disease, it took me to a couple of psych wards. After I got out of the first one, a few days later, I decided that I didn't really want to be on this planet any longer, and I didn't really know what else to do. And so I tried to take my life unsuccessfully, obviously. Thank goodness my higher power had another plan. At the time, I did not feel that way. At the time, I was incredibly upset that I came to. I was incredibly upset with the three subsequent days that I spent in the hospital. I was incredibly angry. I felt more powerless than I did before, because now I'm like, obviously I can't even do that, right? And but really, at that point, that's when I kind of surrendered to my disease, because I said, okay, well, I ran out of options. I think I'm just going to drink, and it'll just be the way it is. I'm just going to drink. I'm going to quit trying. And it actually did get a little bit easier after that, because I just quit giving a damn at all. And I wasn't quite as depressed. I wasn't quite as afraid. Of course, the outside fell apart more significantly. I did the very minimum I needed to keep the parents off my back. My parents were going through a divorce at the time, and I was staying at my dad's, and I would stay up all night. I'd come home at some point, either before or after he went to work early in the morning. I'd sleep for a good part of the day, I'd wake up, try to clean the house up a little bit, make it look good so when he came home he didn't have anything to bitch about, and I'd be gone before he got home from work. And that's how the way I operated. Just don't let him see you and leave you alone. I hid out. And eventually, or around this time, my dad's going to meetings, and so he invited me to a meeting, and he invited me again, and he invited me again, and he invited me again, and finally I was like, okay, I'll go to one of those meetings with you. My first meeting was the Friday night Palmdale Hospital care unit meeting. It's in a hospital that no longer exists. It was in a big, huge cafeteria. The meeting was about twice the size of this one. They had snacks and they had cakes. My dad was a coffee person, and he told me he needed help with the coffee. And, you know, I wanted to help. So I helped him with the coffee. And that my first meeting, I listened to the words, and I didn't really understand what anyone was saying, and I didn't really understand what the speaker was saying, but there was something kind of warm and cozy about that room full of drunks that I noticed right away. I had no desire to stay sober, but I did notice the feeling that I had when I was sitting amongst sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did notice that they had a little bit of joy. So I kept doing what I was doing, and I kept going to meetings periodically to keep my dad off my back. Eventually, he went out of town one weekend, and he left me with some chick who had like 20 days that he was, you know, her and I partied together the whole time he was gone. It was a mess. And, but I hit my bottom in the kitchen with that girl. Yeah, I hit my bottom. I did, because it quit working. It quit working with her. It's just hilarious. She's sober today. Her name is Valerie. She's a hairdresser. She lives in Minnesota. She still keeps in touch. After that, she went back out, and she got in a horrible car accident and completely deformed her face. Basically ripped her whole entire face off in a car accident. So she got reconstructed, and now she has a new face. It took that for her to come back. But anyways, I hit bottom in that kitchen. I didn't know I hit bottom in that kitchen, because the next day I proceeded to do what I always did. And the next day I was in an irrigation ditch with one of those 40-ounce beers with a girl who had a 40, and she wasn't drinking it fast enough, and I wanted hers. And I remember those parts. And then a couple days later, I was shipped off to a sober camp out with a bunch of sober people. And it was my birthday weekend. I was turning 15 that weekend. And I had plans to party. When I left that camp out, I had 3 days of sobriety, and I had a head full of happy, sober youngsters who were all probably between the ages of 13, 14, 15, all the way up to about 25 years old, and they made sobriety look really good. And I was really done, and I didn't really know it yet, but I'd been to enough meetings, and I'd heard enough people say, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. If it doesn't work, we'll gladly refund your misery. And I was like, cool. I can stay sober for 90 days. If it doesn't work, I'll just go back out. No big deal. That's how I approached my first marriage, too. So, we'll get to that. I'll try to give you the quick and dirty. The quick and dirty is I've stayed sober ever since then, one day at a time. I just did what they said. And for me, I did what they said, and I did what I could. Some things I couldn't do, and I did a lot of things horribly badly. I went to a lot of meetings. I went to 2 or 3 meetings a day for my first year of sobriety. I didn't have anywhere to go, nowhere to see, nothing to do. I had zero responsibilities. I was a child. I was full of fear. I wanted you to like me. I tried to make friends with lots of people. I remember going out to coffee at Denny's. I remember eating club sandwiches and nachos. And milkshakes and, you know, just stuff you do when you're new. And I went to every single dance. I went to every single convention I could get to. I went to every single alcathon. I always signed up when there was an alcathon and they needed slots filled. I always signed in my name. I always poured coffee. I always cleaned ashtrays. I wanted to be in the middle of this thing because I was so terrified I would drink again. I was so terrified once I got even a few days that I wouldn't be able to stay sober and I would lose this thing, because when I was out there, I was screwed. There's no other way to put it. So in here, I'm like, if I don't make this work, there ain't nowhere else for me to go, because the way I like to drink is for oblivion every single time. I don't have any interest in having a glass of wine. I've thought about that later on in my sobriety a lot. Like, would you like to have a glass of wine? Maybe you're not an alcoholic. Yeah, no. I don't want a glass of wine. I want a bottle of vodka in a closet by myself. That's what I want. And I want you all to leave me the fuck alone. Leave me alone. That's how I feel. That's what my alcoholism. I don't want a drink. I don't even want to look good while I don't care. Because alcohol for me was my medicine, it was my solution, and it fixed everything until it quit working. And when I say it quit working, right before I got sober, meaning I took a drink and I still, and the feelings did not, the crazy head, the crazy mind, the insanity did not go away. And I was like, wow, they said this might happen in meetings. I heard people talk about this. And I was young and impressionable, and I listened. And I'm so grateful for that. I mean, the beauty of getting sober when you're young is you're impressionable. You listen. That's also not a good thing in other ways, because you listen to everything. And everything you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous becomes gold. You know, people said a lot of things that I took to heart. And some of those things weren't really very useful and constructive. And I found those things out in my late 20s and my 30s. And I keep finding out. But for me, most of the problem was my black and white thinking. That people said, oh, it's this way, and I didn't realize there was some gray areas. Life's got lots of gray areas. So I've got just a very short time to tell you what my sobriety's been like, and I'll try to do that. I got married when I was 15 months sober to a fellow who had 13, who was 13 years older than me. We were married for 19 years. I had 4 children very quickly. When I was 21 years old, I woke up one day and went, oh shit, what happened? I had 4 kids. I was incredibly unhappy. But I, you know, was told in this program stuff, you know, like, do the steps again. If you want to make any major decisions, do the steps again. So I did the steps over and over and over and over again, trying to get this feeling of wanting to get the hell away from that crazy man to leave. And it never left, but I just thought I'd just keep doing the steps to, because it must have been me, because that was my, that was the disease I had before I got here. That it's all my fault and I have to fix it and I'm in control of everything and I'm running the show and I'll make this work. And you know, that was me playing God. That was me not understanding that there is a God and I'm not it. I've had some wonderful sponsors. I started off when I was very new. I went through several sponsors my first couple of years of sobriety. I would get a sponsor because I didn't want someone to ask me if I had a sponsor and say no. So I'd get one. Yes, I have one. What's her name? What's her number? I'd have her name and number. But I would never call her because if I called her, she might ask me a question that I might have to answer and I couldn't tell the truth. And I didn't want to lie. So I would just get a sponsor, and then I wouldn't talk to him for 2 or 3 or 4 or 6 months, and then I would just get another one because I was afraid at that point to ever call them because I was so ashamed that I'd never called them. So I just went through like all these sponsors, and they weren't really my sponsors, but I still remember them, all of them, because they cared, they tried. In that time, I managed to get through three fourth steps in my first 2 years with people who were or were not my sponsors. They were all, none of them were searching, none of them were fearless, none of them were honest. They were me going, I have to do this or somebody's going to hate me or judge me. After I had a few years, I got desperate. I got thirsty and I got desperate, and I went back to basics. And I found someone who had a working knowledge of the Big Book and who I felt like I could tell the truth to. For me, I am unable to do any work out of this book, and everyone's a little different. Tell the truth, make any changes, unless I feel safe. Unless I can tell, like I feel like I can tell you what's really going on. And because I'm a fear-based human being, and I'm a liar, and I want you to like me, and I want to look good. So I finally figured out after a while that I needed to find a human that I could not lie to, that I could tell the truth to. And when I figured that out, my sobriety was transformed. At the time, I could not tell the truth to a female, so I found a male sponsor. He took me through the steps. Since then, I haven't found it necessary to have a male sponsor. I've been able to work with females since then, but that first time around, I trusted him. I could not find a woman that I could trust. So I had all those babies. We moved everywhere. We moved from got sober in Palmdale, stayed there till I was 19 years old and 4 years sober. Had this great idea to move to Colorado. Moved to Colorado for 2 years. Moved to back to mommy's house for a year. Moved up to the Bay Area for 2 years. Moved back to Colorado for 7 years. He was in construction. He was always chasing money. There never was any. I spent a lot of time at food banks. I spent a lot of time selling plasma. I finally got a job as a server at a Red Robin in Colorado Springs when I was out there. And man, I was so proud of that job that I got. I've been throwing papers with those kids in the car at like 2 to 7 o'clock in the morning, bringing the kids with me to the warehouse where the newspapers were at night. And it was hard, 8-7 days a week. It beat the car up too in the snow. But eventually I got that serving job, and you know, all my tips were going to the babysitter. So that wasn't really working. So I went back to mommy. That's kind of when I hit bottom, and I started in. And at that point I said, you know, I got to figure out a way to take care of myself. I got to grow up. And because I was a child, I was still a little child, kicking and screaming, pissed off that my parents weren't taking care of me and weren't doing it right, and they weren't the kind of parents that I thought I should have. And I needed to address those resentments that I had. And I just went over. I've done it over and over and over again. I've done those steps over and over. You know, sometimes I'll be completely relieved. I remember making amends to my brothers. I was living in Breckenridge, Colorado at the time. I was not in a great place. My sponsor's name was Melody. She was a fabulous woman. And I didn't know what they were going to say. And I didn't even really know exactly what I'd done wrong. But I knew I wanted to be clean with my brothers. Because I have awesome brothers. They're amazing human beings. And I wanted to be free when I saw them. So I called up the first one and I said, Russ, I want to make amends to you. And I want to tell you that I know that I've done some stuff that's been hurtful. And I listed those things out, whatever they were. And I don't want to have anything between us. Is there anything that I'm not aware of that you want to mention that I didn't even think about? And boy, he laid it on thick. He blasted me. And it was such an awesome experience because I didn't care. I wanted to have healthy relationships. I wanted to be able to look them in the eye. I wanted to have an ally on this planet. And my brother Russ, man, he let me have it. He reminded me of all kinds of shit that I'd forgotten about. And I was like, wow, sorry. I'm really sorry about that. And then, you know, it was over. It was over. And man, he calls me. He lives in South Carolina now. He likes to hunt and fish and... Like I said, he always posting pictures of Facebook on himself with dead animals. And I was like, awesome. He's so happy, and I'm so happy for him, and he calls me constantly. And that is a blessing of this program. That is a gift of this program, that I get to have that interaction with another human being who loves me. And we get to talk about our childhood. We get to talk about our experience around growing up in that family. And he has grown and I have grown, and it's sweet. So I have about 3.5 minutes to get through about 15 years. Anyway, there's been so many people who've done so many wonderful things for me. 3 or 4 weeks ago, I drove up to Chico because one of the ladies that sponsored me in my first year, she remembers sponsoring me, even though I don't, you know, I remember her sponsoring me too, but I don't remember ever telling her the truth about anything. But we've kept a relationship all these years, and lovely woman. But she was speaking up at a little one-day women's conference up in Chico, and I have another friend, or another woman who sponsored me, who lives in Chico, who's going to it. So I got to go up there, see my kid who's in college, and I got to sit between those two women. Who have stayed sober and have stayed an example, and who continue to be there for me. And, you know, it is just it is a miracle. You know, they told me when I was new, stick around for the miracle. And that stuck. I don't know what the miracle was going to be, but it sounded good. It sounded great and shiny and rainbows and unicorns. So I was like, I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna just see, because maybe I'm wrong. You know, maybe this whole like horrible, disastrous outcome that is in my mind is wrong. Just maybe. And that thought of just maybe I might be wrong has been such a wonderful thought, because whenever I go just maybe I'm wrong, beautiful, wonderful things happen every single time. So those kiddos, they are 23, 22, 19, 18. I acquired a couple more along the way. So I have a step and a foster who are both 18 as well. So there's six of them all together. They're amazing, and they're all completely different. Some of them like me, some of them don't like me. You know, they go through different phases of, we have relationship challenges. 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, I got divorced from their daddy, from the four babies' daddy, and that was really, 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 really hard. Like, no joke hard. Because I was really good at making sure those kids knew that everything was perfect. Everything's perfect. And I made, you know, there was no on-blast ugliness in their face. So when I left their daddy, they were in shock and horror. And they hated me for a really, really long time. And that was probably the most difficult thing I've ever been through in my sobriety, because my children were my life. I worked in my sobriety so much about my recovery has been, I want to heal those wounds that I had and not repeat history on my children. I do not want to do the shit that my parents did to me to them. And I am going to, I'm going to grow and change. And I did, I grew and I changed. And it was painful, but you know, it's all come full circle. It really has. And you know what? Maybe my little girls don't have to repeat history of what I did, you know, because I made some really, really tough mistakes by staying somewhere that's not a good place to stay. And maybe my little girls won't have to do that because I did leave. So I guess that's what I was supposed to say, because my time is over. So if you have any questions, ask me afterwards. And so, thank you so much for having me.